Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon.
Hey, welcome. This is nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in science. Now, unlike on almost all of my shows, my guest tonight is actually not a scientist. He's a business consultant, noted speaker, and best-selling author. His name's Mark Sanborn. But this is the second time I've made an exception to my science rule and had him on my show, and that's because his thinking is so extraordinary, inspiring, and down-to-earth helpful in helping people change for the better. So there's this word extraordinary. Being extraordinary sounds like it goes along with being Beyonce or being somebody who's up for a Nobel Peace Prize. But my guest tonight, Mark Sanborn, actually came up with his thinking on the subject because of his mailman. His mailman, not surprisingly a guy named Fred, because that's in the title of both of his books, manages to do the job of delivering the mail, a very ordinary job, in a very extraordinary way. Not because he's the bionic postman or the postal version of Beyonce. He simply uses his creativity and conscientiousness to be an unimaginably great mailman. On tonight's show, Mark Sanborn will be explaining why extraordinary is something you can choose to be and how you can recalibrate your thinking so you can achieve and maintain that and live and work fulfilled in a way that living ordinary just can't meet. On tonight's show, Mark Sanborn will be discussing his recently published book, Fred 2.0, New Ideas on How to Keep Delivering Extraordinary Results, and it's a follow-up to his New York Times bestseller that I featured last time I had him on, The Fred Factor, How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary, which is what we're discussing tonight. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Amy.
Hi. Oh, I'm so glad you're back. I loved both of these books, and I just, for people who don't know about Fred, as I said, both of these Fred books were inspired by your mailman. So tell us about Fred the mailman.
The real-life Fred the postman's name is Fred Shea. He still lives in Denver, Colorado, and right up until this past July 3rd, he was an employee of the United States Postal Service. He, since you and I last talked, just retired after many, many years of service. But I met him back in 1988 when I first bought a house in the area of Denver where he delivered the mail. And you know, the long and short of it is he's a guy that had a pretty, by most definitions, ordinary, maybe even redundant job, you know, putting mail in a box day after day. But he made it artistry by the way he did it. And really, the message of the book is that both books, Fred, The Fred Factor and Fred 2.0, is that nobody can prevent you from choosing to be extraordinary, you know, regardless of your role, your work, your position. It's about the choices you make and not about the circumstances you face.
And I like how you wrote that the main reason you feel that your first book succeeded, the first Fred book, because you've written others, is that it wasn't about a big name like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett. We hear about them and we tend to think, yeah, they're geniuses. I'm just an ordinary person. What can I do? But Fred really dispelled that.
Yeah, and I think it's important to acknowledge that, you know, successful people can inspire us and we can learn a lot from them, but that sometimes we just assume that until we have the kind of amazing results and success monetarily or otherwise that, you know, famous people have, that we're going to be limited. But I always tell people it's not about, you know, getting a different job in life. It's about doing the job you have differently. That's always the starting point for improving your situation. And you know, I realize that, you know, people sometimes have jobs they don't like and that they do them because they have financial obligations and they want to be able to provide for the people who are important to them. But I guess the good news is that you can start to reinvent yourself by looking at the ways you can do your job differently so that, A, at the very least, you aren't bored. And when you start having more fun and bring more creativity and passion to your work, then the people that you work with and the people that you serve have more fun as well.
Well, I want you just to give a few Fred examples. And one I love is when you came home and you thought your doormat was stolen.
Yes, that was shortly after I met Fred back in 1988. I had gone out of town for a couple of weeks, and when I returned, my doormat was missing, which I thought was kind of odd. And I lived in a small, roughly 1,000-square-foot bungalow in an area of Denver called Washington Park, and I had a little front porch. And I looked around on the front porch, and I found that my doormat was actually in the corner, but it was covering something. And what had happened is that UPS, another package delivery service, had, misdelivered a box of mine a few doors down. And Fred, in the course of making his rounds, saw my box on the wrong porch. So not only did he carry my box down and put it on my porch, but he wrote a note of explanation. That's how I knew this. And then basically tried to disguise it with a doormat so nobody would take it. Now, I know that in the scheme of things, it doesn't seem like a lot, and yet little things make such a big difference. You know, I think that when we do lots and lots and lots of easy, simple, little things for people, they notice and they appreciate it.
And this guy, he just had a habit of caring way beyond, you know, how the average post person, postal worker does their job. You know, people, like you said, they throw the mail in the box, but he got to know you. He got to know your travel schedule. This is his personal service, and he was not getting any extra compensation for being extraordinary.
No, and I think that, in a perfect world, people would be rewarded commensurately for what they do. One of the things that's interesting, and I talk about this in the new book, is that if you only do things for the reward and the recognition, you'll often be disappointed. And oddly, it becomes kind of a quid pro quo, kind of a give and take, and it almost removes a little bit of the excitement out of it. I think that we always appreciate being appreciated, and I certainly think most employers and most people, myself included, could do a better job of recognizing and appreciating others. But even if you don't get recognized, don't let that discourage you. I always say the best reason to do something is it's the right thing to do. And even if nobody else notices, you notice because you chose to do it without the guaranteed payoff of being paid more or getting some kind of special recognition. And that's what always I found inspiring about Fred Shea. Fred told me in so many words, he said, I just live my life this way because I think this is the right way to live life. And that might sound a little antiquated and old-fashioned, Amy, but I think, Fred was proof that he lived a very full life, but still does, even though he's retired now, and has the appreciation and admiration of so many.
And now you talked about appreciation. I think this is something really important that a lot of us don't stop to do, that we complain about crappy service, but that we don't thank people when things are good or great. Even good should get some appreciation, that people are doing their jobs well and they smile and they're nice to you and they go out of their way in small ways.
Yeah, I think it's easy to notice when we get bad service or we're unhappy and we think it's not right and we deserve or paid for better. But I agree 100%. It's also refreshing if you have a great wait person to thank them and point it out to their manager, what a great job they did. Or if you receive an extraordinary act of service from someone, to at the very least thank them, because that goes such a long way, in reinforcing and perpetuating that kind of behavior. And my work for the last 25, almost 26 years, speaking and writing books and advising others, I've never had anyone complain about getting too much recognition. And I've had people complain about a lot of things, but, I've never had anybody say, I just hate that I work at a place you can't do anything without somebody thanking you for it, slapping you on the back. It's making me crazy. Never heard that. And yet the way most people manage or sometimes run organizations, you'd think that praise was the most costly thing there is because they give out so little of it.
It's so stupid because when you praise people, they're encouraged to do more. And it's also just, it's soul-killing to sort of do a job where you do a good job, put in an effort, and that nobody ever notices or it doesn't seem you're making a difference. And you talk about how just it was such a wonderful difference this waitress made when your wife was sick. So tell us that story. I love that story from your book.
There's a Mexican restaurant not too far from where we live in South Denver, and some years ago when our kids were smaller, and we used to like to go there on Monday nights because on Monday nights kids ate free, and so a lot of Monday nights we'd take the boys and we'd go to this Mexican restaurant. Well, one Monday night, my wife Darla was under the weather, and she said, "I'm just going to stay home. Just you know, get me something to go. So when we went to the restaurant, our wait person that night was a young lady named Alicia. And she was really good and very personable, and the service was great. But I told her at the beginning of dinner, I said, you know, my wife's not feeling well. I'm going to order something now. Please kind of time it so it's ready to go when we're done eating. Well, at the end of the dinner, she brought out, you know, the to-go bags with two, you know, styrofoam boxes inside. And on one of the boxes in red ink, she'd written, "Hope you're feeling better, smiley face, Alicia." And, of course, you know, when I got home, my wife's like, "Hey, who's Alicia?" But, you know, after I explained to her who Alicia was, you know, she was really touched by that. And so the next time we went back, we made it a point to sit in her section. And what I like about that story, besides the thoughtfulness, is, you know, she didn't spend any money to really do something nice for us as her customers. You know, she had a red ink pen, and she had a little creativity, and she was thoughtful. And that, again, flies in the face of this idea that you've got to spend lots and lots of money, you know, to do better business, create more value, make customers happy. I always challenge my clients and my audiences to replace money with imagination and to replace capital with creativity, you know, to outthink rather than outspend your situation. That's true for your family, too. My wife and I are celebrating our wedding anniversary tomorrow. And so I always try to think extra hard, you know, what little touches, what little things can I do, not just buy a nice gift, which she certainly appreciates, but what can I do to demonstrate, you know, how much I value her? And she reciprocates. And it's about being thoughtful first rather than just throwing money at our problems or our opportunities.
And just to name what you're talking about, it's really, in these cases, Fred, putting the UPS package on your doormat and the side of your porch so your package wouldn't be stolen. Alicia writing this on the, you know, just get well, you know, on this carryout container. This is showing people you care about them. And it means so much to people. And as I've come to realize that, I have, whenever I get service that is in any way, you know, above the average, I will either tell the person or, for example, I have a new puppy and I've been taking a lot of trips to the vet. And this woman there, she's just a great woman. She's compassionate. She was there when my dog died, my last dog. And so I wrote her a letter just saying a little card, just, you know, one-sided, you know, thank you. This means a lot. I'm sure it means a lot to other people. And I bet that meant a lot to her because I bet other people feel that way but don't tell her.
Yeah, it's interesting because in Fred 2.0, I tell a story about a vet tech who she loves people and she loves their pets. And so at Christmas time, she does these little gifts and cards for the pets. And, you know, to somebody that might sound silly, and she's fully aware that they're animals. But, you know, she loves animals and she knows that by showing concern for people's pets, the people know she values them too. And you just, you know, that's what your story is about. And I say to people, and it sounds maybe like a little kind of a silly saying, but, you know, people don't know you care until you show you care. You know, how many times has somebody said, you know, I don't feel like you appreciate me. I don't feel like you love me. I don't feel like you value me. And people like to argue and say, oh, you know, I do. But that's the important point to be made. The reason they don't know it at a deep level, they don't feel it because someone doesn't show it. You can tell somebody you love them all day long, but if you don't spend time with them, if you don't invest in the relationship, then the words are hollow. And at an intellectual level, knowing it isn't the same as feeling it. So people don't know it until you show it.
No, it's absolutely true. And like you're saying, it's small, small ways. Greg will be mad that I say this. He sometimes will hide chocolate for me in my house. You know, and it makes me happy, and he tells me where it is when I'm having a bad day. And it's just such a small but such an important thing, you know, that he prepares for when I'm having a bad day and there's hidden chocolate treasure in my house. It's just those little yeah. things, you know, that make your relationship really great when people think, oh, you have to buy diamonds and tennis bracelets and all this other stuff and do all these things. It's really just those little things that show somebody that you're there for them when the chips are down.
Well, unfortunately, money often becomes a lack of, it covers for a lack of imagination. You know, we think if we just buy an expensive gift, that's enough. And certainly, again, I'm not speaking against that, but I think that it's the little things, you know. It's the demonstrations of thoughtfulness, like you just mentioned with the hidden chocolates. I'm going to mention that to my wife. I think that's a great idea. She could do that for me, but I don't want her to tell me where they're hidden until I'm, you know, until I really need them, or else, you know, I'd gobble them all down. That's right. The one area I don't have a great deal of willpower. So,
in case of emergency, right? You know, yes. Break glass. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is business consultant, speaker, and best-selling author Mark Sanborn. His book we're discussing tonight is Fred 2.0, New Ideas and How to Keep Delivering Extraordinary Results. And I love his last book, too, The Fred Factor, How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. Now, you talk about people making ordinary jobs extraordinary stand in stark contrast to indifferent employees, unhelpful coworkers, rude experiences, and we often think of these as normal. And you say that there are some arguments for being normal, like that it's easy and familiar, but you argue that it doesn't take much to, as you call it, recalibrate to great.
No, it doesn't. And what I say in the book, I quote Peggy Noonan, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, one of my favorite writers. She was a speechwriter in the White House for Ronald Reagan, and she's just got a great way of expressing ideas. She was talking about the last presidential campaign where Obama and Romney were running against each other, and they were both, to some degree, trying to convince voters they were just down-to-earth normal guys. And Peggy Noonan made a comment. She said, you know, first of all, anyone that wants to be the president, you know, of the United States, the highest elected official in the land, you know, the highest elected leader in the free world, isn't normal. Let's not kid ourselves. You know, that's not a normal aspiration. That's a pretty lofty ambition. But then she ended that kind of tongue-in-cheek statement with, and besides, normal is overrated anyhow. And I think what she was saying is that maybe, you know, we should all aim higher than normal or average, that, you know, maybe, you know, being in the median or the mean isn't the most exciting place to live life or to do business. And the nice thing is that, you know, it's about a decision. You know, nobody has to be anything. You know, we live in a free country where, you know, outside of our obligations to pay our taxes and follow the, you know, the laws of the land, we choose, and I've met people who, for whatever reason, were, you know, happy as clams, just getting by. And if that's true, you know, if people aren't in denial, if that really is true, that's enough for them. God bless them. But I think for so many people, they just don't realize the greater potential and opportunity they have until they see someone like a Fred the Postman or an Alicia or you know, the vet tech, and that kind of strikes a chord and says, you know, wow, I could be more than I am. I could be beyond normal. I could choose extraordinary.
Yeah, it's so interesting how you make this so practical in your book and how it's such small things. And one of the principles that really strikes me, your four principles of being a Fred, doing ordinary things or ordinary jobs in extraordinary ways, is the philosophy that you can add value to everything you do. And if you think about it that way, how can you make this sort of ordinary job, you know, being the person who checks people in at the medical center or whatever it is, how can you make that better? How can you be the best checker inner that there is without, you know, also, you know, spending thousands of dollars to give people cash and prizes when they come in? It doesn't take that, as you say.
No, and sometimes it's a simple matter of when you ask someone directions, and it's refreshing if they've got time to actually take you rather than tell you, you know, especially if it's in a medical facility or an office complex where it might be hard to find the location. You know, it's just, again, I call it ABCD, above and beyond the call of duty. When you go above and beyond the call of duty, then you have created value for people. And, you know, like I walked out of a restaurant last night with my family, and there was a young couple taking pictures of their two young children on kind of an autumn Halloween theme bale of hay pumpkin. And I just stopped and I said, would you like to be in the photo? You know, and now in this particular instance, they didn't want to be in the, you know, in the photo, but more often than not, you know, people kind of pausing, oh yeah, it'd be great. Because, you know, if you got a family, there's always somebody missing from the photo, right? The man or woman or the kid who's taking the picture. And so I learned a long time ago, you know, it takes 20 seconds, and it's just something that's minor, doesn't cost anything, but is always appreciated because it's thoughtful. You know, Alicia, like I mentioned before, her value add was a red ink pen and a great attitude.
And I love something you say about this. You say, there's this quote from your first book, The Fred Factor, your first Fred book, nobody can prevent you from choosing to be extraordinary. And you make this point that people can choose to be extraordinary on their job, in their relationships, in their friendships, just with these small things.
Well, yeah, you know, we don't. There's a lot we don't control at work, and I say, and I'm a realist. I mean, I've worked in and consulted and advised corporate America for, you know, over 30 years, 20, 25 years in my own business, and so I'm a realist. But I always tell people, you know, your employer may not encourage it or reward it or pay for it or train you for it, but you can still do it if you want to. And I understand that, you know, sometimes people just get burnt out and they say, why bother? Why try? But you ultimately choose to be ordinary or extraordinary. For some people, it's easier. That's why I think it's great, you know, if you grew up in a home where you had encouraging parents and you had access to education. And by the way, if, you know, you're a parent listening tonight, in the new book, I talk about Fred Jr. And I say that, you know, these principles, the earlier they're taught and learned, the more they'll benefit a person. You know, kids get this stuff if they're taught and rewarded at a young age. They can carry these ideas through life. Other people, sometimes because they didn't have that kind of parenting as kids, they don't learn these principles until much later.
You know, in fact, I just realized this principle basically, which is amp it up. What are you doing? What's the normal thing to do? Amp it up. That this is what I do in my writing to write humor, that you take the thing that you thought of, okay, yeah, I had that idea first. Okay, how can I really, really push this? And then push it more and push it more, because without that, it's just sort of run-of-the-mill. And you can choose to live a run-of-the-mill life. Like you said, some people seem satisfied with that, I guess. But these people who live this kind of Fred life where they go above and beyond, there's actually a lot of science behind it supporting that the way to be happy is to have meaning in your life, which you get actually from doing things for others. And I don't mean in a sort of communist way of like you have to walk around in paper shoes and give away all your money, but just that you extend yourself, and that makes you feel like your life means something.
There's an old saying that says a person all wrapped up in himself makes a very small package. And I think that self-absorption, you know, it really, and I know even though I'm not a scientist, I do read a fair amount in psychology and neuroscience, and we know that when people become self-absorbed, they don't form meaningful relationships. Those meaningful relationships add years to longevity. I know you're familiar with the research that the more meaningful relationships people have, the longer they live on average. People of faith, people with a spiritual orientation, which more often than not keeps them looking beyond themselves. It's always about, you know, your impact on others and being of greater service. People of faith live longer. So there's a definite correlation, as you mentioned, Amy, between what we're talking about here. This isn't just do it because it's warm and fuzzy, but the good news is the universe is designed in such a way that when we do these things, you know, what I call the right things, that we often benefit from them.
Yeah, actually, there's this research. I cut it out of my next book. I didn't have room for it. But Randy Nuss and Stephanie Brown at University of Michigan found that adults who are 65, that if they did these things like help the neighbors, picked up the neighbors' kids at school, that they actually lived much longer. They had more longevity than people who didn't do those things. You know, it's just amazing. You see these things over and over again, how people's health lives are improved in these ways. And you point out also, I love this, being a Fred, being that person who does ordinary things in extraordinary ways isn't more fun.
Yeah, I've never met anybody doing these things that was miserable. Now, I've met people who felt like they were forced to do these things and didn't want to and made themselves miserable. Nobody wants to do anything, you know, out of obligation or compliance. But, you know, when you just decide to do it, you know, a great example for me is I'm pretty disciplined, not so much on chocolate, but I work out typically 6 days a week. I get up in the morning. First thing I do is I exercise. And I've often been asked by friends and others, well, do you always feel, you know, you must like to exercise more than I do? And the answer is I probably don't, because there's very few mornings when I start to exercise that I feel terrific. I do it because I know by the time I'm done exercising, I'll feel terrific. And I think we sometimes kind of put the emotion in the wrong place. The emotion comes from the doing, not just the attempting. And so at the end of a 30 or 45 minute workout, I feel pretty good. Not necessarily the thing I most wanted to do 45 minutes earlier, but I think that if people just try some of these things, see how you feel at the end, and if over time you don't feel better, then quit doing it and try something else.
And you mentioned this a little bit before, you alluded to it, but Sonia Lubomirsky, who does happiness research, she talks about how in her research she's found that people who force, you know, they have a checklist and they have to walk an old lady across the street every day and it's not from the heart, that actually doesn't make you happier. But these things, you know, when you're doing stuff and you have a purpose behind it and you're passionate about it and it means something to you, those things do make a difference. And I love this notion that you're not in the mood isn't a good enough idea. And I actually, one thing to help with that, I use a clock when I'm writing, because sometimes you just wake up and you just feel stupid and not funny and unclear. And what happens is if I set my timer for an hour, by the time the hour is out, I mean, I've usually written something of value, a sentence at least, and usually more because you get into that state of flow.
Well, and even if you don't, you've got something called rewriting and rework. You know, I think we need to remind ourselves, we ought to say, well, on second thought, which is this colloquialism that says, you know, we thought about it again and came up with a different conclusion. What would happen if we gave things second and third and fourth thoughts? If we just kind of didn't take the first thing that popped into our mind. When I write, like you, I will often edit and re-edit and re-edit and re-edit. I'll work on a 500-word blog three or four different times, tweaking and changing and editing. And if I just throw that first draft up there, you know, it's probably passable, but I know it's not going to inspire anyone. I know it's not going to make a significant difference. So that little extra effort, you know, sometimes perhaps as tedious as that sounds, just that little extra effort, those additional thoughts really pay off. I call it taking the path of some resistance. You know, we all say, you know, take the path of least resistance. Well, if you do, you're going to be weak. You're going to have no reserves. You're not going to really be fit for a vigorous life. Sometimes, like my buddy Rory Vaden says, he wrote a book called Take the Stairs. And his whole thing is you want to burn off a few more calories and stay a little more mentally and physically fit. Instead of taking the elevator, find the stairs. And that's that additional amount of effort that will make you a better person. And then he applies that to all areas of our lives.
Yeah, that's so important. That's training. You know, I've had so many guests talk about that getting in the habit and doing these things and exerting yourself, and that really the lazy way out, it really is not ultimately easy in the end. You know, it's just not making people happy the way they think it will, or not happy, but just it's not fulfilling. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm speaking with business consultant, public speaker, and best-selling author Mark Sanborn. His book we're discussing tonight, well, actually we're discussing both, but his newest book is Fred 2.0, New Ideas on How to Keep Delivering Extraordinary Results, and it's a follow-up to his New York Times best-selling book, The Fred Factor, How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And I love these books, so I recommend them. Another thing you talk about, I just mentioned passion. You say that people should find their passion, but passion isn't enough, that it has to fuel hard work.
Sure. Passion is like a gallon of gas. You know, if you don't have an engine to put it in, it's got great potential, but it's not going to ever achieve it because you've got to ignite that gas before it turns into power. And I think a lot of people, you know, I guess a good way to explain it is people will say, you know, I'm really passionate about something and then I know I'm going to succeed. Well, not necessarily. I know a lot of passionate people who are destitute, broken, and unhappy because they never found a way to channel their passion into effort to create results. You've got to have both passion and process. You've got to have that desire and the work. And by the way, sometimes you do the work even when you don't have the passion because you know that by doing what needs to be done, that will free you up monetarily and time-wise to then do what you want to do. I grew up on a farm. I was lucky. I didn't get a choice, and I didn't get to choose before I was born. Do you want to be born into a family of wealth? Do you want to be born in a suburb, in a city, or a farm? I grew up on a farm. I never remember being asked if I wanted to go out and bale hay or if I wanted to do chores. Now, my parents were conscientious when I was in school. They made sure I didn't have to get up too early to, you know, to do those chores. But in the summer, I actually was one of the few kids that was okay with school starting again, because what I did all summer is I baled hay and worked in the fields. And I'm so grateful, you know, these many, many, many years later, because I developed something that, again, you know, kind of like Fred Shea, is maybe a little old-fashioned and out of vogue, but I developed something called work ethic. I didn't do it because I thought this baling hay, this standing in the hot sun behind a tractor and a baler and stacking hay, man, this is fun. Forget, you know, we didn't have video games back then, but, you know, forget all the other things. I just want to bale hay. But I learned that you do what you need to do. And I think that when people, I don't know what's happened to the idea that we only should have to do in life what we want to do. Wow, I don't know. And maybe not on this planet, not in this life. Maybe somewhere else in the solar system, you know, in the planet of Goofy, you can just get away with doing what you want to do. But we all do what we need to do so that we can eventually do what we want to do. I think that's kind of how life works for most of us.
And I don't really think these are old-fashioned values, because it's the working hard. I mean, that's how to be successful. And you have this point in the book where you mention all these people who think, oh, I'll write a best-selling novel, you know, and make $1 million. And so few people do that. And so, you know, you talk about writing the best book you can, enjoying the writing process, enjoying helping the reader. And so then your happiness and your success aren't dependent on making some list.
Yeah, Tim Ferriss, you know, the 4-hour work week, 4-hour body, 4-hour cook or chef, you know, he said something once in an interview I read that I thought was quite profound. He said, do whatever you do so that the process is the payoff or the enjoyment. Because if you write a book and the only payoff is it's a bestseller, as you mentioned, the odds of that are very, very slim. But if you write a book because you enjoy writing and putting your ideas on paper and sharing it with others, even if you only sell 100 copies, the process will have been as much of a payoff as the outcome. And I think we often, you know, we often say, well, you know, if I can't win the golf tournament, I don't want to play golf. Well, then you're probably going to be a very unhappy golfer. Most of my friends at golf just enjoy the game. They enjoy it more when they win, but they don't stop enjoying it because they don't win.
Yeah, and it's sort of what you're describing is sort of reasonable passion, that you can have a passion for, say, music. Your passion shouldn't be becoming a famous rock star or R&B star or whatever, because it's just so unlikely. And if that's the passion, it's such a losing battle for so many people.
Yeah, and my friend Larry Winget, who's got a best-selling book that just came out called Grow a Pair, which is a fascinating metaphor for becoming assertive and not being, you know, not being rude or mean, but also not being run over in life. You know, it's about having the fortitude to do what needs to be done. You know, he talks about passion. As a matter of fact, I quote him in my book, and Larry and I have been friends for many years, very different in our approach. And yet, even though we have different styles and different ways of doing things, we tend to agree with what each other say. You know, Larry makes a point that passion without hard work is pretty much worthless. But I also make the point that hard work becomes inspired when you can infuse it with passion. So I don't think it's an either or. I think it's an and. We want to the degree we can, be passionate about what we do. If we can't, do what needs to be done. But to the degree you can, infuse passion into your work, and you'll go from being, you know, a cover band to being an original.
And it does sound like an old-fashioned idea. I feel like I'm about to sound like my dad when I say this, but you know, I see throughout the book that there's a level of respect that the Freds, these are the people doing ordinary things in extraordinary ways, that these people show for the work they're doing. And you write about Ted Williams, who must be a baseball player, I don't know for sure. Greg, my boyfriend and producer, is laughing at me now. But you write about Ted Williams taking each at-bat as seriously as the one before. And there's something really wonderful about people who don't get jaded and start getting lazy once they get big.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I mean, we all fight that. I certainly have to fight that, but I've told my colleagues in the professional speaking arena when I speak to other speakers that I tend to work just as hard or harder on a free presentation as I do a paid presentation. Now, I always bring everything I can to a paid presentation. I owe it to the client. I want to be good. It's the lifeblood of my business. But nobody ever says, well, you know, I heard a speaker the other night, and he really sucked. But after all, he was speaking for free, so that was okay. No, people don't. You know, if you're going to take up people's time, you owe it to them to bring your A game. And so nobody says, well, because, you know, I know you get paid minimum wage, so you can be indifferent or rude, or I know you're not, you know, I know your manager is a real jerk, so, you know, you can treat me like he treats you. People don't make those excuses. So all I know is when I show up wherever, you know, whether it's at work or whether it's with a client or even, you know, with my family, I want to bring my A game. Not every day does it happen, but I don't ever let myself become complacent and think that I can get by with anything less than my best effort.
It's so, so important. In my own work, I write a column every week, and I really work hard to, I see that I do things that terrify me all the time. I think, oh my God, how am I going to write this? And only by doing that do I think I stop myself from being a hack. And I see in what you're saying, you know, this commitment you feel, you talk about it being a choice to be extraordinary, and you also say commitment is a decision, it's not a feeling.
Well, it is. I mean, on a good day, we feel committed, but if you are only committed when you feel like it, then, you know, you're not committed all the time. Commitment is a decision to do something even when you don't feel like it. That's how I define commitment. I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, I've mentioned we're celebrating a wedding anniversary. There have been some days that my wife didn't like me or I didn't like her or we had a spat or we weren't getting along, but we didn't say, well, you know, since I don't feel warm and fuzzy about you today, I'm going to go on a date with somebody else, even though we're married. I mean, that sounds silly, but you know, if you just go with the feeling, you do silly things. And what's funny, and I'm not trying to proselytize, but here's my experience, is that over time, the commitment sustains you and deepens the feeling. But the commitment comes first. I know everybody falls in love based on the feeling, and then they make the commitment. But the reality is once you make the commitment, if you stick to it, same with exercise. You know, you don't feel like exercising, but if that's your commitment, over time, the feeling improves. And for, you know, a lot of people that are into sports or some kind of a musical discipline, they get that, you know. Practice is what makes us better. And in a way, commitment is like a non-negotiable practice in a relationship. And you know, it isn't always easy, but it's always worthwhile.
I love how all these things are actually so simple, these principles you break down. I'm talking with business consultant, public speaker, and best-selling author Mark Sanborn. His book we're discussing tonight, Fred 2.0, New Ideas and How to Keep Delivering Extraordinary Results. And we're also talking about his last book, The Fred Factor, How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And since we're talking about these goals and that you keep meeting, talk a little bit about goal setting. You suggest posting a goal you've written down beside your phone or your alarm clock so you'll see it when you wake up in the morning.
I do. Oh, by the way, Amy, before I forget, because I tend to be a little ADD, if someone would like to read just online the story of Fred Shea, they can go to fredfactor.com. I posted the first chapter to the book at fredfactor.com. And if they want more information about this whole philosophy, they can go to marksanborn.com/Fred2, just Fred2 in those spaces. Because, you know, one of the things I believe is that, you know, in this age of the Internet and digitization, we like to kind of extend our thinking and our conversations, what we hear and see with other resources. So that's one way that your listeners can go beyond the time that we spend tonight.
But that story about Fred is so, it's very inspiring, and it made me, just reading the beginning of the book made me want to read the rest and buy it and give it to people. So now going back to goal setting, as you were saying.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think, you know, I'm not the world's most avid goal setter. I have found that, you know, I always have more fun splashing around in the water than sitting on the shore watching other people splash around. So I think that we often, that our lives evolve just by being constructively active, you know, just by doing and trying things. I'm not the kind of person like that, you know, John Goddard, who was, you know, one of the greatest goal setters of all time. I think at the age of 14 or 15, he wrote down 100 goals and achieved something like 88 of them. But what I do say in the book is, if you have a simple goal, no matter what it is, whether it's to be more Fred-like, to use the language that I use in the book, or to be better at work or improve a relationship, by writing down a simple, tangible goal and keeping it somewhere visible, it's just a way to remind yourself, because all action begins with awareness. A lot of people just, our lives are so crowded with other demands that the things we want to do get pushed to the back burner. So having a simple goal where it's visible on a post-it, you know, a sticky note, or in your journal, or, you know, on your computer, just keeps that awareness higher so that it increases the likelihood that we'll take consistent action to achieve that goal.
Now, being a Fred, this person who does an ordinary job in extraordinary ways, or lives extraordinary, you talk about how this takes creativity. And a lot of people think you have to have blue hair and work in some cool business to use creativity on the job, but you really don't. So how do you explain to people how they can do their ordinary jobs more creatively?
Well, I have a chapter in Fred 2.0, as you referenced, about that. But I think there are a couple things that we can all do to be more creative. And the first is that we forget that sometimes creative isn't just different, but it's better. So we start with that question, you know, how can I do what I do just a little bit better? And we put ourselves in the shoes of the people we're doing it for. You know, I always say that the one-a-day principle, of all the things I've written about in all my books, the one-a-day principle is one of my favorites, because it says find one person each day you can do something extraordinary for. Now, do a good job for everyone. Don't try to delight everyone. You know, you always hear that business cliche, you know, delight the customer. Well, you're not going to delight every customer. Some customers you're going to make happy. Some customers you're going to satisfy. And frankly, if you try to delight everybody every day, you're going to get so far behind, you're going to be demoralized. But find one person a day. Just because you can't delight everybody shouldn't prevent you from delighting somebody. And maybe if you want to really bump up your relationship with your spouse, once a day make it a point to tell him or her something you really appreciate about them or love about them. Once a day, tell your son or daughter, you know, encourage them or reinforce something that they did. And so the one a day principle takes this kind of huge and seemingly insurmountable goal of being better or more creative or different, and it makes it attainable by saying you don't have to do it for everybody, but just find one person or one situation where you can do that.
Yeah, I think that that's really important. And just this thing that you said, you know, sort of think more, think beyond. If you just do that, you think, and combining that with what you said before, basically that caring about people, showing that you care, is so important. So how do you show that to the people in your life, whether it's your relationship, your friend, or somebody you're in business with? And I think that people realize, wow, you care about me, you went that little extra step, it really means a lot to them.
Oh, I concur. But, you know, again, it's about awareness first and then taking consistent action.
And now you say something very interesting. You say there's a difference between a difference and your difference in making a difference.
When I wrote The Fred Factor, I talked about, you know, that Fred's, you know, make a positive difference. I kind of addressed this idea that everybody makes a difference. There's no neutral. You know, you either make a positive or a negative difference, because if you think you're neutral, the odds are quite high people are going to think you're indifferent, that you really don't care, you know, because neutral people tend to be, you know, less engaged and detached. And mostly, you know, I guess I'd rather sometimes you disagree with me than ignore me, because at least if you disagree with me, I know I've got your attention. So I think that we've got to get past this idea that at some kind of practical level you can go through life being neutral. So that means you either make a positive difference or a negative difference, and of course most people would choose to make a positive difference. So when I wrote the book, I said, you know, choose to make a positive difference. When I wrote Fred 2.0, I thought of all the people I've met who would talk about how they made a difference, and it was almost always coupled to their passion or their talents or their interests. Like Fred Stork, who is I met a long time ago, worked for a large engineering company. But Fred's hobby is he's a gardener, and he is an award-winning he raises award-winning roses. And so one of the things he's become well-known for among his friends and colleagues is sending roses. If someone needs encouragement, he'll send them one of his award-winning roses. If he's thanking them, they'll send him a rose. If it's their birthday or their anniversary, I'll send them a rose. And the point that I make is that encouraging, thanking, and acknowledging, those are all kinds of generic differences, good things that we can do. But when you add your imprint, what it is that's unique to you, that's what makes it your signature difference. Everybody makes a difference, and I think we should all try to make a positive difference. But it's even more fun and challenging when we say, what is it about me that's unique that I can use to not just make a difference but to make a signature difference?
And I think one thing that you talked about earlier in the book that I loved, there are people who look at their job. They have a job that they're a cog in the wheel somewhere and that they understand the main point. And I love this story you told about a guy who works at Scholastic Books who drives a forklift. And then the CEO of the company asked him, what is your job? And he said, to help children love to read. And I thought, oh, my God, that's so wonderful.
It is because, you know, I grew up with Scholastic Books. I, you know, was an avid reader. We had a bookmobile, you know, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth. And rural America, this big, giant van full of books would come, you know, every Saturday, I think it was, and I would go check out as many books as they let me. And then in school, we would order, you know, Scholastic books, you know. And they were relatively inexpensive, and you know, so I'd order books from Scholastic. And these many years later, the company has, of course, evolved over time and changed. But I read about this exchange with the forklift driver, where the president asked him just that. Now, I know that, you know, someone who's a cynic goes, you know, is probably saying, "Look, he drives a forklift." But what people don't understand is that's just as important a process of getting a book into the hands of a kid as writing it and printing it and delivering it is. Somebody's got to help in that distribution chain. And this person could have been, you know, a cynic, or he chose to infuse his passion into his work of driving a forklift. And I really admire that about anybody that says, you know, what I do on the surface may not seem important, but what it enables, what it supports, how it ultimately impacts other people, it really does make a difference.
It's so, so important. And the thing you said before about how do you make this yours, I want to emphasize to people, and I'm getting this out of your book, and by the way, I'm talking with Mark Sanborn. He is author of Fred 2.0, New Ideas and How to Keep Delivering Extraordinary Results, and The Fred Factor, How Passion in Your Work and Life Can Turn the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to grow roses or make cookies or have some talent. You just have to see within your sphere, well, how can I make things better? And another great story you have is about a dentist who remembers old people's birthdays. That is so great. Tell that story.
Oh, that's my friend, Dr. Matt Messina in Lorain, Ohio. And he's been, from the beginning, he was a big fan of the Fred Factor. And I was pleased to be able to talk about him in Fred 2.0 because he and his staff of Fred's, you know, and I know the language sounds kind of corny and silly, but it's in fun. It's the spirit of the Fred Factor that I hope people embrace. And Matt and his staff noticed that a lot of their older dental patients didn't have a lot of living friends or relatives, and so when they would come in for a teeth cleaning, if it was anywhere near their birthday, they would throw a little impromptu birthday party. They just inventoried in their storeroom just a few simple and expensive items. And, you know, I have a great photo of Matt and his team with a 92-year-old man, and he's holding a cupcake with a candle in it.
Oh.
And they would throw these impromptu birthday parties. Didn't take very long. It certainly didn't cost very much. But here's the cool part of the story. What they found out is these older patients started scheduling their appointments on their birthdays. Because, you know, they just think about it. You know, at some point, it's sad, but, you know, we kind of if we're lucky, we live long enough that we just don't have all those people around us. And so Matt Messina, dentist, his staff, they found a way because they, and by the way, they value their patients. This isn't some kind of corny facade. They do it because they love their patients. But their patients, their lives are enriched, not just because they have clean teeth and good oral hygiene, but because those people at the dentist office care for them.
Right, and like we mentioned before from Sonia Lubomirsky's work, it has to be real. You can't just be checking off things on a list and doing them. It has to be from the heart. But I wanted to ask you, what about the naysayers, people who discourage you for making a difference, who judge you for doing it? What do you tell people when they're worried about that?
Well, it's tough. You know, we all hate criticism and we don't like rejection, but you got to basically say, am I going to let people I don't like determine how I live my life, or am I going to live my life and not worry about them? I mean, it's kind of when you kind of look at it that way, it's a little bit silly. It's kind of like, well, these people that are critical, I don't like them and they don't like me, so I'm going to live my life so I'll make them happy by being less than I could be.
I would tend to think that those people who criticize you for trying to go an extra step, that those people look bad when you're doing more and they're doing just what's expected of them.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, I worked many years ago with a 5-star hotel in Las Vegas, and I spoke to the staff there, and a woman came up afterwards, and she said, oh, you know, I so believe in this, and I didn't, you know, call it this, but I've been doing this for many years, but it's so discouraging because the other staff say, oh, you're making me look bad, don't be so good at what you do. And of course, you know, it reminds them that they're loafing, or that they're, you know, they're sandbagging it. So they're encouraging her to sandbag it too, not because they care about her, but because they're self-absorbed and they don't want to work hard. And I said to her, I said, I don't have a magic trick or a gimmick or a technique that will make them stop, other than you have to ask yourself, am I going to live my life and do business in a way that I feel is right, or am I going to let others who are unwilling to do more than necessary determine how I live my life? And that's really, I mean, kind of the dilemma, but ultimately where we have to choose.
And now you have some steps and some words for building better relationships I wanted to get into because they're so great. And one of them, because a lot of people who read your book are reading it for help in their business, not just their relationship, not their relationship with their wife or husband or boyfriend or whatever. You know, this is a surprising one. You say love is a word that people need to remember in their business relationships as well, and that you have this great quote, love in work clothes is about treating people with dignity and respect.
Yeah, love is a choice. It's not a response. You know, we choose how we treat people, and I think the test of love is when we can be civil and treat people with respect, even when we would prefer not to, you know, even when it's difficult. I mean, it's easy to be nice to nice people. And by the way, I'm not talking about letting, you know, and I hate this, but the reality is sometimes people are sensitized. I'm not talking about letting people run over you or take advantage of you. But for instance, when we often respond to somebody who's unhappy or unpleasant by being unpleasant, we just reinforce the negativity. So love simply says, you know, if my spouse is having a bad day, I love him or her, that I am going to do whatever I can to help them be less negative, not, well, because you're negative, I'm going to be negative. I mean, that's childish. It's like, well, you hit me, so I'm going to hit you, you know, or, you know, we see this in the political process. Well, I'm not budging, so you're not budging. You're not budging, so I'm not budging. Love is less a warm, fuzzy feeling. Now, I'm not talking about love between, you know, sensual or familial or any of that. I'm talking about the practical kind of love in the workplace is about treating people with dignity and respect because they've chosen to either employ you, they've chosen to do business with you, they've chosen to work with you, and love is a very high-level concept that benefits both the giver and the receiver.
And actually, this echoes the words, I think, of Eric Fromm, who said that loving is not a feeling, but something you do. And you talk about that, again, you're not just laying down and being a doormat, but that you knowingly cut people some slack, you extend the unmerited favor. When you see that people are having a really rotten day and you just want to extend some compassion to them and alleviate whatever they're going through.
Well, maybe this will help. I always use this example. I give myself the benefit of the doubt easily. You know, if I'm in a bad mood, I've got good reason to be in a bad mood. I didn't sleep very well. My flight got canceled. I got in late. I mean, now, I'm being facetious, but not completely, because I always say people aren't rational, but they are rationalizing. You know, we're not always rational beings, but we're really good at rationalizing. Why is it we then assume the worst of somebody else? Well, he's in a bad mood. It's because he's a jerk, not because he had a fight with his spouse. It's because, you know, she's unpleasant, not because she's got a loved one who's sick in the hospital. I just simply say, if we're going to give ourselves the benefit of the doubt, what would happen if we gave others the same benefit of the doubt? We would probably mellow out a good bit. At least I know I would. And most of this stuff I learned by being wound too tight. You know, I'm a type A left brain. I mean, I'm the typical kind of person that gets all wound up, takes themselves too seriously, is more critical of others than I am of myself. So I've had to learn this the hard way. You know, this isn't preaching. This is as much a confessional as it is encouraging others to choose this path.
But actually, you tell a great story, and I am similar, type A, you know, hot-headed, and it's really important when you've been a jerk to back off. And your great story you tell is about when you were speaking at a convention and you ran into the badge police. So tell that story.
Yeah. Caesars Hotel in Las Vegas a year ago this past June. I was in a hurry to get into my room to set up for a presentation, and I had not registered because I'd gotten in late the night before, and a guy whose name was Joel was a security, and they were checking credentials to let people into the meeting. I said, you know, hey, Joel, I'm the speaker. I didn't have a chance to register. I really need to get in. And he didn't let me in. And I was, you know, I was frustrated. And again, I could, you know, give you the context, but the reality was I was curt and abrupt and I really was a jerk. And after I finally went and got my credentials and he finally let me in, after I set up, you know, and I just had a breather, I realized, you know, the problem wasn't Joel, the problem was me. And I went back and I apologized and I shook his hand and I told him he was doing a good job. And I tell that not to for self-aggrandizement, because to tell the story, I have to admit I was being a dork. I tell the story because it was redemption. I'll say redemption is a choice to take what you did wrong and make it right. You know, it's the ability to apologize. It's the ability to say I was wrong. And it's such an amazing feeling. It releases the other person, but it also releases you, because very often, you know, we just kind of, you know, we want to stand by our side of the story instead of saying, you know what, I probably was too abrupt. And yeah, it might have been nice if he showed me a little dispensation, but hey, he's a security guard. What do security guards do? They got, you know, it wouldn't be a very good security guard. Says, well, you know, you really shouldn't come in, but what the heck, you know? That would be an insecurity guard. You know, that would be the opposite of that. So, and in the new book, I talk about kind of the doctorate level course in relationships that includes words like compassion and grace and mercy and love.
Yeah,
and redemption. That was the redemption. Five words you won't hear in business school.
But they're so important, because you can really rebuild something that's really gone downhill by admitting you're a jerk and cleaning up after it instead of holding your ground. And this is part of being an extraordinary person, is that when you've been not so extraordinary, that you admit it and pull back from it and tell the person you're wrong. It's just so important.
You know, and I think part of the reason that they aim at so hard for people is, you know, I think adults – you know, I've got two kids, and I've learned from doing a lot of things wrong and a few things right that we as adults think that if we admit we're wrong, that this is somehow a weakness. But what happens is if we never admit we're wrong as adults, we raise kids that never admit they're wrong when they become adults, because, you know, kids learn through example. And they say, well, I never heard my father apologize for losing his temper. My kids have heard me apologize for losing my temper because there's no way I can rationalize that. It's funny, when my kids were little, I used to yell at them about yelling at each other. I mean, think of the irony there. I would raise my voice to get onto them because they had raised their voices. Well, that's silliness, you know? So if we don't teach kids that there are times when it is appropriate, when you're wrong, to apologize, we raise a generation of people that just, you know, never could admit they're wrong.
That is so absolutely true, and it takes a big person to admit that they were little. This has been just a wonderful show. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. Thank you, Mark Sanborn, business consultant, public speaker, best-selling author. Thank you. And we've been talking about Fred 2.0 and The Fred Factor, both books I recommend. So get those, and you'll find out more about what we talked about tonight.